Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. That means, folks, we're really running out of time. And actually, we've got Tammy back with us, and that debt is fraud, and we need you to invoke the power of prayer and any kind of whammy that you got, but other than, you know, deadly force, those types of things. So actually, Tammy, I'm going to do a go back, because when we really look at our form of government and this responsibility of enforcing the laws ourselves, and had we the people accepted, remember that thing of liberty, accepting our responsibility?
Mm-hmm.
See, I try to tell people we're the problem, because we didn't want our responsibility. We allowed them to create these mercenary forces and then create these pretexts and so forth. I mean, we had a big part to do with that, right? And for the most part, for a long, long time, we didn't see the need. As a matter of fact, here's the little interesting thing people can chew on. Because when we look at World War I, this is the first time we actually called forth the army to do something that the army had no constitutional responsibility to do. And that was basically to go fight a war on a foreign soil. This was huge. Was America going to commit a violation of the Constitution to help the French out of this world war with Britain? Or not Britain, I mean Germany. And so the question is this. Had we actually held that line, what would have changed? What would have been different? We don't know the outcome, but do we really believe that what was happening between Germany and France and in Europe, the destabilizing and all of that, that our lives were necessary? As a matter of fact, had we actually stood up and basically said, France, if you want us to fight in this war, you have to petition to become a state in the United States. Had we actually opened that door to say, we're not putting ourselves in harm's way unless you are a part of us.
Right.
We wish you the best. We don't think that what's going on is good, but we do not have the authority to invoke any of this, you know, to invoke these international laws and so forth, that we get involved in this world war. So, looking at what we should have done in that context, and then looking at how we failed, look today at where we are militarily with deadly force, weaponry, sophistication of the weaponry and the technology that they use. Do we really believe that we can defend ourselves against an army and or a military force with, I mean, muskets aren't equal anymore. In other words, what we see the people have is so outdated that, yeah, you might be able to put up some kind of a resistance, but who cares? I mean, as long as you stay in your little quadrant, they will permit you, but the moment and point in time they need to take your quadrant, they will have it.
Right. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
And I think we're fooling ourselves when we really put so much stock in the right to bear arms. I think that we've lost sight of the importance of our responsibility. That's really the crux of the problem, is that we have to actually take back, and this is how we have to do this at the county, then we have to do this at the state. And it doesn't have to take a long period of time, especially in red states. When people start getting this, they're going to go, wow, you know, this is actually a great government. It's very limited and defined, and we the people have far more power and far more say in this government. We've just allowed them to say, oh, it's difficult, and they don't use the technology to involve us more and more. The only reason the people weren't as involved in the Republican form of government in 1789 is that they didn't have telephones. They didn't have virtual meetings and those types of things to where the people could actually get more involved, maybe not in the decision-making, but in strategies and saying that this is the direction this nation needs to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one thing for a president to speak about, you know, the direction of our foreign affairs, but when it comes to strategic, you know, domestic matters like our energy and those types of things, that's not for the president to decide. That really should be for the people in the states to decide. Anyway, so as we dive into the rest of the story, or I should say the rest of the constitutional amendments, the 11th one is the first one that we kind of dive into. Now, this was basically a quick snapback when the states actually started seeing the federal court intervening in between cases, and I forget the actual case, but the federal court actually intervened in a case between a private citizen of one state who was suing a different state. And so the 11th Amendment was ratified in 1798. It was proposed in 1794. Now, this is a state-sponsored amendment. In other words, this didn't come from Congress. Congress didn't say, hey, we got a problem here. We need to fix this. So in other words, the proposal of this amendment, so this is the 11th Amendment that was proposed by the states, right? And so... all they did was they changed the language of Article 3, Section 1, to where if you look at, I'm going to split my screen, but what I'll do is I'll go up and I'll read that part of Article 1, Section 3, or actually Article 3, Section 1. Why do I get that wrong each time? So it says right here that the judicial power, it's Section 2. The judicial power shall extend to in all cases in equity arising under this Constitution, laws, and... I'm right. It is Section 2. I was wrong. It's not Section 1. But this is where it changes. It's in that part of two controversies to which between the United States shall be a party, two controversies between two or more states. And then right here is where the 11th Amendment kicks in. Between a state and citizens of another state. That language right there between a state and citizens of another state had been changed, and this is what gets injected, that the judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any suit in law or equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the United States by a citizen of another state or by citizens or subjects to any foreign state. So in other words... if somebody is trying to sue the state from France, this is a private citizen, or the France itself, the federal court has no jurisdiction over it, based on the 11th Amendment. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So here's where the state said, hey, we don't like you getting into our knickers. We are sovereign states. We'll defend ourselves in our own court. And so down the road, after the 14th Amendment was being redefined by the courts itself, the court actually started taking back and basically defying the 11th Amendment. In other words, they used the 14th Amendment to say, oh, because of the 14th Amendment, it changed the 11th Amendment when it didn't. There was never any context that it would ever change this shift or this snapback to the state's powers over court jurisdiction. Okay, so the 12th Amendment we kind of covered already. We covered this when we covered Article 2, Section 1. So when we dive into the 13th Amendment, we actually have a few here, right? So the first 13th Amendment, actually, before the 12th Amendment, we actually have an amendment that was proposed by Thomas Jefferson. I don't want to read this, but this was an amendment that was proposed as an artifact of the Louisiana Territory. In other words, when the Louisiana Territory was created, or they finally, you know, purchased the Louisiana Territory, Thomas Jefferson looked at the Constitution and goes, you know what? We can't give land to the Indians. And a part of this land, it was his desire as the president of the United States to basically grant the federal, or I should say grant the Indians through, you know, like a foreign policy, part of the foreign affairs, that we would grant them land out of the Louisiana Territory. And actually, when you read this, it gets into the details of the land between, if you look at the second part, it says, the legislature of the Union shall have the authority to exchange the right of occupancy in portions of the United States, have full right for lands possessed by Indians within the United States on the east side of the Mississippi to exchange lands on the east side of the river for those on the west thereof in the latitude. So he actually starts identifying the area of land that he wanted to actually grant the Indians to have their own land and nations. That's where all of the tribes would be able to, you know, find their, you know, find their way amongst each other as a separate sovereign nation in the midst of the United States. In other words, it wasn't granting them, you know, the property or the land all the way to the West Coast. This would have been kind of in the center from the Rocky Mountains out into the plains to the Mississippi. And so it was a big chunk of land. And Congress did not, I mean, they just, you know, didn't want to have anything to do with this. They weren't even going to touch this. Because, and the problem was, and he was pointing out, that the federal government did not have the authority to grant land to the Indians. It was their responsibility as the stewards of the Union to administer all lands for the Union. And so they had the ability to dispose of land by giving them to a foreign state, but not to actually grant land for the Indians to use within the Americas as a part, as a separate autonomy within the, if this makes sense, right, to create a state within a state or a state within the Union. And so anyway, long story short, he was looking at this problem and they said, that's all right. We'll march through with this without worrying about that. Now we got the 12th Amendment, which we covered a long time ago. The 13th Amendment, which is the very first time an amendment came forward right after the 12th Amendment. Actually, this was proposed in 1810. It was ratified in 1812. Now, it is contested, but it is stated this was ratified in 1812. This is the, if you read this, go ahead and read this, and so we can digest this, because this is an important amendment that is actually not being recognized today. Go ahead.
If any citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, receive, or retain any title of nobility or honor, or shall, without the consent of Congress, accept and retain any present, pension, office, or emolument of any kind whatever from any emperor, king, prince, or foreign power, such person shall cease to be a citizen of the United States and shall be incapable of holding any office of trust or profit under them or either of them.
Okay. So what is that set telling you? How do you interpret that?
Well, if we accept, if we have any title or nobility from any other country, then we rescind our citizenship.
They have to rescind their citizenship. They can no longer be a citizen. So what is a title of nobility or honor or, you know, a pension? Because they talk about this. It's not just a title of nobility. You know, it's not just being a prince and or a princess. It's a title of honor. You know, like Bill Gates has the honor of being recognized in China, right? or shall give consent, accept, or retain any present, in other words, a gift, pension, office, or emolument of any kind whatever from an emperor, king, prince, or foreign power. Such as person shall cease to be a citizen and shall be incapable of holding any office of trust or profit. So when we look
at... That would make sense, because that's conflict of interest.
Well, right. So when we look at lawyers today, we actually recognize that they take on this, you know, esquire under the bar. And so is that within this realm? Because the British Accredited Registry, by giving them a position as a bar attorney, in other words, you now have, you're a member of an organization, the British Accredited Registry.
Yeah, which is messed up.
Right. So in other words, people that actually pass the bar because they receive this title, and it's not necessarily a title of nobility, it's a title of honor and it's not necessarily a pay, but it is a state. It is the membership or the ability to practice law within the state you pass that bar. So technically, lawyers cannot actually maintain their citizenship and be able to serve. So when we look at the different, and what I'm looking for, and you might not see what I'm doing here, I'm actually looking for the compiled laws of Wyoming. And have you ever seen that book?
Mm-mm.
No, you've never seen that book. Okay, so folks, I want to kind of take a little bit of an unusual break, because I'm feeling moved that we need to probably go down this path of looking at this. And actually, you'll find this book on the Constitutional Articles page. So when I go there and I look up the Constitutional Articles, there's this book called The Compiled Laws of Wyoming. And I'm not seeing that. Why am I not finding Wyoming? Because I wanted to put in, there it is, The Compiled Laws of Wyoming. See, I got it. I knew I had it. Go ahead and open up. And so what we want to do is we want to go to the Constitution. I think it's page 20-something, where they go through the Constitution and all of that. And it's in the very front end. So just forgive me, folks. We're skimming through the book where they're going to cover the Constitution, right? And this book was the provincial or the territorial government in the territory of Wyoming. I don't want to say chartered. They appointed I think it was Mr. Livingston, and it was his responsibility to actually go out and get all of the laws of the land, all of the laws of the territory, the Constitution, all of the laws. And what you see here, I've finally gotten to the page of the Constitution. And as we go down into the page of the Constitution, you know, this is including all of the stuff. There's the powers of Article 1, Section 8. There's Article 2. And we keep going and keep going. And then there's the signatures. And now we have the amendments, right? So here are the amendments to the Constitution. We see the second and the third, and we see all of the amendments. There's the eighth, the ninth, and here's the tenth, where the power is not delegated, right? And then we see the judicial power. We just read this. The judicial power shall not be construed. Then we see the 12th Amendment, which we talked about. Now guess what we see for the 13th Amendment? What do you see there? Read it. Go ahead and read it. Can you read it?
If any citizens of the United States shall accept, claim, receive, or retain any title of nobility or honor, or shall, without the consent of Congress.
Now stop right there. Does this not sound familiar with what you just read?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is the compiled laws of Wyoming. In other words, when Mr. Livingston went out in 1870, whatever, it was in the 1870s that he was commissioned, there's the word, he was commissioned by the territorial government to actually establish the laws of Wyoming. And in that, he was incorporating the Constitution and its amendments. And in this book, he actually cites the 13th Amendment. You see that now, right?
Yeah.
So when we look at this today, and we look right here, I tell you that this was ratified in 1812. So you shouldn't be surprised if it was literally ratified in 1812 that you'd find it in this book, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it makes sense that a ratified amendment would be found in this book unless there was some contention or something like that. And apparently there's been no contention regarding this. The point is this. If it's in this book and it's not in the Constitution today, what happened? When you look at your Constitution today, what everybody says, that's the legitimate Constitution. Not looking at the annotated Constitution, looking at the legitimate Constitution, and you look at the 13th Amendment, that's not the 13th Amendment. And as a matter of fact, this next amendment isn't the 13th Amendment. This next amendment was actually proposed and signed by Lincoln, but it was never ratified. So there were actually three 13th Amendments. This amendment that was signed by Lincoln says, no amendment shall be made to the Constitution which will authorize or give to Congress the power to abolish or interfere with any state and the domestic institutions thereof, including that of persons held to labor or service by the laws of the said state. In other words, this right here guaranteed the states could never lose their ability to maintain slavery. This was going to galvanize slavery in the Constitution. Well, actually, technically, you'd need to repeal this amendment to do that, right? But when we actually look at the real 13th Amendment that Lincoln then later on submitted after the emancipation, go ahead and read what we see today in the Constitution as the 13th Amendment.
Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction.
There you go. And Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by proper appropriate legislation. Now, when you read this, this is the first time this creeps in. What does that mean? Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate, in other words, they have the power to create law for enforcement. Does this mean that Congress will actually be able to, you know, Congress themselves will get on horses and grab their guns and go enforce this? No. Does this one article change the execution of the laws in Article 1, Section 8, that Congress have the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws? No, what this does is it's kind of a redundant claim. And everybody looked at it and they go, hold on here. Does this give Congress the power to create a standing army? No. If they were going to have the power to create a standing army, they would have to undo Article 1, Section 8, the militia clause. Because then they would basically say that Congress shall have the power to call, you know, to create an army to execute the laws of the Union and will no longer use the militia to execute the laws of the Union. They'd have to have some language to basically negate that the power of calling forth the militia. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, because what this does is it only says that they have the ability to create legislation.
Right.
They don't have the ability to execute or get their own, you know, mercenaries to execute the laws. So, shoot, with that, we're actually already going into a break. And, man, time flies when you're having fun. Anyway, folks, we're going to go into a break real quick, and then we will come back and dive into some more of the amendments, and obviously the 14th is next. So we'll be diving into the 14th, and we should be wrapping up. It shouldn't take too long. I'll probably get long-winded. I'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Wow, that kind of snuck up on me. Sorry about that. But okay, so now we've clarified that there were actually three shots at 13th Amendments. And I don't believe that in 1861, or actually 1865, when Lincoln did this amendment, it wasn't really being called the 13th Amendment. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so now I'm confused. Which one is the 13th?
Well, the 13th is the one you... The first 13th is really the 13th. The question is, was this amendment ratified? And so technically, yes, this should be the 14th. The amendment that abolishes slavery, this should be the 14th. And what we call the 14th would be the 15th. And so on. In other words, all the amendment numbers would slide. Because... we actually have, and actually, unknown to most people, go ahead.
But if you look at a little pocket constitution, you don't see the other one.
That's so the reason why I think that this constitution that we have, the color-coded constitution, we actually put up the proposed constitutional amendments, because I think you can equally garner and learn from the paradigms of the states or the government at the time when they sought an amendment. And I'll get to it when we go into 1926. But when we actually look at, you know, some of these proposed amendments, like that one where Lincoln wanted to actually galvanize slavery. And then he had to reverse himself. He literally had to reverse himself and admit that he was wrong and say, no, we got to end slavery. I've got to make this war about ending slavery, not about, you know, economic infliction and punishing the southern states. So, anyhow.
Which you say, so for that one, though, proposed 1810, ratified 1812.
Yes, that is a legitimate amendment. I mean, it's in the Wyoming. As a matter of fact, if you look at the 14th Amendment in that Wyoming compiled laws. Let me pull it back up. I've got it right here, just waiting. If you look at the 14th Amendment, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude. See, they actually list it as the 14th Amendment. See?
Oh, wow.
That was in 1870s. And there's a document just like that for Colorado that created the compiled laws of Colorado. And they actually have it exact same. That the 13th Amendment was the Nobility Clause Amendment, and that the 14th Amendment was actually the ending of slavery.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, what's the truth then? The truth is that these were legal documents that were formed. In Wyoming and Colorado, they actually created a legal snapshot of the land. So here's the question. How did the 13th Amendment get expunged and everything slid down one notch? How did that happen? And it had to have been a huge, and I'm telling you, because back in those days, they didn't print everything. There are very few people that actually had copies of. And so what they did was they started printing and shifting these things. And reason being is that the 13th Amendment on the Nobility Clause, there wasn't a lot of infliction of that because most people just didn't understand it. In other words, how many cases actually went into court over nobility clauses? It was, and as a matter of fact, when you look at the court system itself, it actually probably did everything it could to wash its hands and say, we don't have jurisdiction over that. Something like that, to where it never made it into the court. The point is somehow they expunged that from the record, because that's a, you can get that book. I have it up on my website. You can download that, but you can also find it in the Google library, and you can also find it in the archive.org library. It's an actual book that's been scanned, and that's what you're seeing are the scanned pages in a PDF. Isn't technology great?
Yeah.
And it's also used under, you know, all of these other problems. So actually, now we have the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment, I could spend a lot of time going over whether it was ratified or not. It was ratified, and I've already covered this on the show several times. Now, folks, if you want me to go through and do a special show over the drafting of the 14th Amendment and its ratification process of how this was legitimately ratified, you know, you can actually look at Wikipedia. Believe it or not, Wikipedia, not too many people academically say go look at Wikipedia, but interestingly enough, even Wikipedia points out that, you know, this amendment was actually properly ratified. There were three states after it was ratified, there were three states that started pushing back and saying, we want to unratify this. The problem was that the federal government did not accept the de-ratifying or the de-cert. Once you ring the bell, you can't unring the bell. The only time you can unring the bell is if the government, if the federal government says, yeah, we'll allow it.
Why did they want to unratify it?
Why were they unratifying it? Because they, well, you got to understand that in the 1860s, we were very susceptible right after the Civil War to, I'll just say, the intrigue of foreign states, specifically Britain, coming into America. And Britain had been basically buying our politicians and owning them and getting them to actually do things that were violations of the Constitution. So shortly after we do this, we're going to go back into the curriculum. We're going to finish the Constitution. We're going to wrap this up. And then we'll get into, we're going to go back into the resolutions that we were doing before the Constitution. Remember that? The Kentucky-Virginia resolutions. We kind of put that aside to do this. So now we're going to go back into that. And then there's a couple of things that we'll probably look at, like the Logan Act and a couple of other key things that happened. And then we're going to dive into the Organic Act. And we're going to spend time going through the Organic Act and the treaty with Britain, this unconstitutional treaty with Britain that happened in 1871. The reason that this unconstitutional treaty and the Organic Act was passed was this is what Britain did instead of saying, we're going to take you to war, America. So here's the funny thing. You know, hindsight may be 20/20, but in some ways, I think there were just some people that were absolutely corrupted, and they may have used some form of logic to say, you know, I think that, you know, what we are doing or what we did here in this Organic Act is, you know, the best thing for us. But in all honesty, the Organic Act undermined the Constitution. What it did was it gave the power and the ability for the federal government to basically institute or create corporations for every vestige of government. And in so doing, this was a mechanism of incorporating everything to where Britain was able to hold the stocks or the shares or these corporations where they could actually take money out of the federal government. This is how they got to remember, we're going to get into this in the 14th Amendment. And as a matter of fact, since we're here, let's jump into it. Let's jump all the way down to Section 4 and tell me what Section 4 states. Go ahead and read this.
The validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment or pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. But neither United States nor any state shall assume, or pay any debt or obligation incurred in aid of insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or any claim for the loss of emancipation or any slave, but all such debts, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal and void.
Okay, other than the fact that it had the assume in there twice, what is this saying? So it's basically saying up front, the uncolored part, that they, the United States has the ability to authorize by law, you know, debt and the payment of these pensions and these things. In other words, what we do financially can't be questioned. But neither the United States nor any state, in other words, any state in the union, shall assume or pay any debt or obligation incurred in aid of insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or any claim for the loss of emancipation of any slave. In other words, there was no reparations. They put that there, but by the law, there is no reparations, because, and unfortunately, they didn't understand this, that when you look at an ex post facto law that says something that was legal at one point and now it becomes illegal, you can't create a punishment for those people that were exercising something that was legal. You can only punish them after the fact. So in other words, if you're committing slavery, then you get punished. But they could not create a fee for the sins of slavery. The ex post facto law that prohibits a law to basically change something that was legal, and then now we can punish you because now we call it illegal. Right. That would be an ex post facto law. So the Constitution already protected this concept of reparations, period. You can't use reparations under the Constitution because the law has changed. Or that law would be an ex post facto law. So as we look at what they're saying here, is that they're not to basically pay any debt, because it says, but all such debts, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal and void. Well, the southern states, who are they in debt to? And the southern states at this point in time weren't in the Union. And the southern states at this point in time were not allowed to just join the Union. And as a matter of fact, in Article 4, Section 3, Congress has the power of admitting states. When those states left the Union, they left. Lincoln may have said something that was law, but Lincoln didn't have the power to make law. And when Lincoln said that states can't leave the Union and he wanted to prosecute the war against them, he prosecuted an unholy or an unconstitutional war because states could secede. Now, what Lincoln should have done is Lincoln basically should have used the Monroe Doctrine to say, okay, you guys are out of the Union now. And now we as the United States, by using the Monroe Doctrine, will say we will not allow the acts of slavery to exist in the Western Hemisphere because, and for whatever reason, he could have actually gone down that path. But he didn't want to. Remember, he had the opinion at the very beginning going into his presidency that I'm okay with you keeping that, but you got to stay in the Union. And so he had the wrong paradigm. And he had to eat crow. There is talk that he prostrated himself after recognizing after 2 years of losing the war, he was going to fail. He had to finally admit and acknowledge that his course and what he was doing was a failed course. And this is why everything turned around when he made it about slavery and ending slavery. Now, all of a sudden, he realizes that the states did leave the union, that the only thing he could do is basically, you know, pummel them and make them in slavery. And that was the condition and the outcome of the war, that they were going to end slavery. And that's why the federal government created the Freedmen's Bureau. And they started going down this path of doing things that technically the federal government shouldn't have been doing because they didn't have the power to do until the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment created these protections from these states. But technically, those states weren't in the Union. So at that point in time, they were being occupied by the Union. And that's why the Freedmen's Bureau was actually being set up to do that. But as soon as these states came back into the Union, they became a sovereign state again. The problem was that as these states in the South were behaving so badly. Now, folks, in New Orleans, in Louisiana, New Orleans, in 1866, when the 14th Amendment was actually going around the nation to be ratified. It got submitted in June and was already out. In either July or August, I could look it up if you want me to do this, and actually Kurt Lash points it out in his thesis that in New Orleans, there was a convention of freemen that were basically all motivated in getting into public office. They were running a campaign of a freeman campaign because they wanted, because you got to remember, in New Orleans and in Louisiana, it was a slave state, and most of the slave owners were black. A good percentage of them, I shouldn't say most. A good percentage of them were black. And so, and because of its relationship with France prior and all of that, it was just this quagmire. It didn't have common law, it had civil law. So Louisiana was just this really outlier state. And there was this large convention. And I want to say it was around 200 men were massacred in that convention by law enforcement and government officials of Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And because they did that, and that hit the news, this became an outcry in America that injustice and that thuggery could not be accepted. And it was one of those things that absolutely put wind in the sails throughout the state legislatures that they ratified this amendment. And it was a mandate. It was the first time an amendment became a mandate on social issues. The next time it was the mandate on social issues was prohibition. But we've never had another mandate towards social issues. We've had assumptions. In other words, health care, all these other things that the federal government has done. But the point is this, that the southern states were not in the Union, they were not protected by this part of the constitutional amendment. Does this make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think if you owe Britain a lot of money, and you don't have, I mean, you were really thinking you were going to win the war and not be devastated because the northern states were losing. They didn't see any way of them losing. So they actually, you know, kept on borrowing money. And next thing you know, they had their backs to the wall and said, we need more money if we're going to save ourselves. And it just wasn't enough because all of a sudden the tide had shifted because of the tone of the war. You can't tell me if you have a righteous cause, you can't overcome. And that's what I have to say about reclaiming the Republic. In a righteous cause of taking back liberty, we will overcome. Every time we see this throughout history, whether it be Martin Luther, the Civil War, even in Egypt, you know, the two times in the history or the annals of mankind, the two times that slavery was overcome, and both times are not taught in school of how and why they were overcome. We get this rhetoric of this politics and so forth of how it was overcome in America. It wasn't overcome by the typical what we would see as, you know, this political war or something. It was actually for the We go back to the Constitutional Convention in 1789 or 1788, the 1787 convention. But August 22nd was when basically George Mason said that this nation would be punished and these states would be punished for maintaining slavery, because he basically called out every slave owner as a petty tyrant. And because God can't punish nations and states in heaven, he will punish this nation and these states. That's what he basically said. And so he forecasted this death or this calamity that would fall upon this nation because of slavery. And so when you look at what has to happen to come to the next level, you have to sanctify yourself. When we talked about the proclamation, when I talk about the proclamation of thanksgiving, there are ways of sanctifying your law. There's ways of sanctifying with God what you're doing. And sadly, in many cases, when it comes to egregious sins, one has to spill blood. And this nation spilled blood to free itself from the tyranny of England, and we prevailed over that tyranny, and we won. And it's the same thing that we had to prevail over the tyranny. And as a matter of fact, Europe and mainly Britain was doing everything they could to destroy the United States. And because the tone had changed, we prevailed because it was about liberty. And so we sanctified the nation once again by the spilling of blood. But sanctifying event is once you've been blessed, you actually set aside, and the proclamation to me, you sealed the deal, because this is when the nation actually for one day served him who gave us the Constitution. And I don't believe that there was necessarily that same level of sanctifying by the people of the United States, because I think we were still split, because I think the biases and the prejudices that were the byproduct of slavery truly existed to where we didn't come together as a nation after that war. And what ended up happening was it basically set the stage for us to actually have to deal with all of the shenanigans of the Jim Crow laws, which were, all of these things were unconstitutional. When you look at how the Jim Crow's, and I could dive into all those, but nevertheless, I only got 5 minutes left and I didn't want to take this much time. But the point is that they sanctified this nation once again by the spilling of blood, and these states that left the Union were constrained from coming back in. The only way they could come in is if they ratified the 14th Amendment. However, the ratification of those states coming in were not counted towards the ratification of the Constitution, or I should say the ratification of the amendment. When you look at how many states out of the three-fourths of the states that were in the Union, they made it by two or three states. They didn't need those other states because they actually ratified the Constitution without the southern states' numbers being counted to it, if that makes sense. Because Tennessee did, they were like one of the first states that out of the South that actually ratified the 14th Amendment, one of the first states. But you put all those numbers from the southern states that were ratifying, it didn't amount to anything. They still legitimately ratified by states in the Union. So go do your due diligence, folks. You'll find Wikipedia has all of this. Now, the only thing that is not clear in Wikipedia is when they start saying that these three states undid their ratification. They rejected it. They ratified it, and then they tried to reject it. The question is, could they reject it, and was that counted? Yeah, they rejected it. They signed some formal documents, but it wasn't counted by Congress. Congress said, no, you've ratified it, and you can't undo that. You had your choice, and you chose to ratify it. Done. When Congress starts allowing an amendment to be unratified, then okay. But the 14th Amendment was never open to be unratified. There's only one amendment that had been opened to be unratified. And that was the 17th Amendment. We're going to get into that, but we've got just a few minutes left. We just started touching the 14th Amendment. So I said we'd be done with amendments in a day. There's way too many other amendments we're going to cover. But what we want to do what we want to do is the very first line of the section one, the all persons born or naturalized. This right here is such a hotbed issue. I think we need to wait till tomorrow to cover this. So let me ask you this. When we're looking at what we just covered on the debt, does it make sense that the southern states, it was the irresistible force, right? I mean, mm-hmm. this was an offer they couldn't refuse. If you look at what they had to pay Britain, if they stayed out of the Union, the Confederation was dead. Financially, right. They were dead. Not only were they beaten.
So they came in back in so they could relieve themselves of all their debt.
Absolutely. And when that happened, that's when Britain, in 1868, when they realized what was happening, they started injecting money into the political realm. And they didn't make hardly a dent in 1868. But in 1869 and 1870, they were pouring money big time into opponents to run against these radical Republicans to actually unseat them. And so in 1870, in that election, that is when they succeeded in removing enough of, just keep in mind how many radical Republicans there were. When you look at the 14th Amendment, the radical Republicans had such control over both houses of Congress that there was no debate. I mean, the Constitution, when they finally went up to vote, you know, to pass the 14th Amendment to move to the Senate, boom, done, one vote. Three-fourths of the House of Representatives passed it, then, or two-thirds. And then it went up to the Senate, and boom. They were going back and forth and debating, and they kind of all came to a consensus that, yes, we've got a good amendment here. Boom, it was passed by the House. Boom, it was passed. They did that for this 14th Amendment started at the very end of March, and it was done by early June. Mm. That's how fast they worked through this. And they got it out because it became the referendum for the 1868 election. And it actually swept in through the states. But when this was going out, this is when the Britain started pouring in their agents and so forth to start corrupting and getting people to actually start running against the radical Republicans to unseat them so that they could seize control. And when they did this in 1870, this is why they did the Organic Act, and they did everything they could to try to expunge the 14th Amendment. And we'll get into that in the next show, because literally we're, you know, I'm down to 30 seconds here. Any other questions, though? Anything to illuminate? Okay. All right. So we'll cover section one, section two, and section three, hopefully tomorrow. And again, section three happens to be that point, or, you know, that dot that connects to the oath of office and the petition. Section three is the teeth, if that makes sense. So folks, with that, we are going to call it a day, but I'm hoping that this is kind of really helping and that we kind of understand how important the 14th Amendment is to the original constitutions, especially when we hit section three tomorrow, if we hit it tomorrow. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.